Hi, and welcome to the Macro Show. We talk macro, and you wonder, is a blowout payroll report really going to send yields higher? Or is it really just a delusion of the Bond King's enemies? We've got that, and we're going to go through the ISM report, payroll report, infrastructure. I'm even going to do an explainer of my own interview on Macro Voices. That's right, I'm your host, Steve Van Meter, and thanks for joining me today. And I'll tell you what, all week, maybe even longer, all I've heard is and seen is articles saying that payroll reports are going to beat expectations. Well, it only seems likely considering states are reopening. And as restaurants go to, say, here in California, 25% capacity from zero, well, yes, you're going to need a potentially a quarter of your servers back and a quarter of your other staff back to run that. So yes, we knew payrolls were going to go up. But this was an opportunity for everyone to say that a big number, a big payroll number, is going to send yields through the roof. It's going to be unstoppable. The 10-year is going to get to 2% and then keep going from there. Nothing's going to stop this. But is that true? Well, let's take a look, because there's only one way to find out. That's right. Chart it out. So here we have all employees, total non-farm in blue. And you can see they're rising, except they fell here during the pandemic. And they're long ways off from where they need to be, but they're rising. And here is 10-year treasury yields declining. Now, I don't know about you, but it certainly looks to me that the relationship is that as payrolls go up, yields go down. Of course, I say that tongue-in-cheek because I'm not actually convinced there is a relationship here other than people making it to be something that's not. Well, let's go ahead and invert the payroll report and see what happens. And survey says, that's right, that apparently as people go back to work, interest rates go down, or you could just simply say there is no real relationship here. I mean, maybe there is. I mean, you can see here payrolls went down, yields crashed, they went back up a little bit, and then they went back down. I mean, even as jobs are being added, you could see yields are falling. So is there really any relationship between the number of jobs, number of people hired, and interest rates? Well, if there is, it's certainly one that is absolutely bond bullish. All right, well, let's talk about the infrastructure bill, because there was something interesting in that, and I thought I heard remnants of a border adjustment tax. Now, many of you probably have no idea what a border adjustment tax is, and I strongly encourage you to go look that up and read about it, because it's actually very interesting. So what did we learn? We learned it's going to be, well, projected if it's passed as proposed. And mind you, this thing could take many, many, many months and may never see the light of day, but it's still interesting because, again, I think border adjustment taxes are really cool. And I want to share that with you. So $2 trillion over 8 years means it's going to be $250 billion a year. Now, is that in itself inflationary? If it's borrowed, no, but we're going to get some tax increases. So could it be inflationary if we had it? Sure, now, but a $250 billion a year, did I say month? I meant a year. Can you really see a lot of inflation from that? No, not really. So we're looking at 28% corporate tax rate. That will be bad for earnings, which is probably one of the big reasons we're not going to see this thing pushed through. And then a 21% tax on global's earnings with a deduction if manufacturing is moved to the U.S. Let me explain to you what a border adjustment tax is. And let's just use two countries. We're going to have a closed system. There's two countries, one with a high cost of living, one with a relatively low cost of living. So what happens over time when you have this relationship? What happens to wages? Well, the belief is, right, that the lower cost of living country is going to see the wages and standard of living rise. Does that actually happen? No, it goes the other way, because there's usually other reasons, maybe political or, you know, government reasons why the standard of living is low. And it's not due to lack of money, because, well, if that was the case, then central banks would just print money and make everybody rich. So what normally happens then is over time, the standard of living goes down and wages go down in the other country with a high cost of living, because these workers over here are competing with low wage workers over there. And so it never works the way it's supposed to. So what a border adjustment tax does, if this is masquerading at one, and if that's the intention, I don't know. Does it work well when the dollar is a world's reserve currency? Again, don't have all the answers, but I think this is kind of interesting. We're talking about is what it says is, look, we've got an unequal playing field here. And what we're going to do is we're going to tax goods and services coming in to the high-cost country from the low-cost country. And why are we going to do that? To bring the cost of those goods up to the same level so we can protect the standard of living and wages of the high-cost country. Makes pretty good sense, right? But maybe everyone's not cool with that. So to encourage people or encourage manufacturers and producers in other countries to hire workers from the high-cost country, there are deductions and tax breaks to move those factories and jobs into the high-cost country. And so the idea is to say, look, if you're building, say, a car in a low-cost country, we're going to tax you to make it either perhaps uncompetitive or equal to what you could do if you built it here. So build it here. And by the same token, you know, we're already building, if you're in a high-cost country, you already probably got a factory building cars in the low-cost country because it's cheaper. So if that's what I'm hearing and that's what's happening, I actually think that's pretty interesting. Don't know if that's the case or not, if that's the intent, but I've, you know, ever since I heard about border adjustment taxes, I thought, man, that is really cool. Why don't we do that? Of course, probably a lot of things you probably wonder why we don't do them. But let's go on. We've got into the economic data. I want to come back to the initial jobless claims after we go through the payroll report, because the initial jobless claims still is a huge question mark on what's going on. All right, so let's get into the market manufacturing PMI, M-A-R-K-I-T. Now, there are two different manufacturing surveys. There's market. They're kind of the new kid on the block. I think theirs is a little more accurate. And then there's ISM. And ISM is considered the official. It's not officially from the government, but it's considered the official manufacturing purchasing managers index report. There's a survey of purchasing managers and what they think is going on. So here we look at a print of 59. Over 50 is expansion, under 50 is a contraction. And so this is saying the manufacturing sector in the United States expanded at a slightly faster rate than the month before. And a 59 print is a pretty good number. That is saying, hey, there's solid expansion in the U.S. manufacturing sector from market. Now let's go to ISM. And you see that it went from 60.8 to 64.7. That's a strong number, but the ISM throws some other things in their calculation that can make the number a little higher. So you say, "Woo! It looks like there's a real big expansion," but it can show up in other things such as shipment issues and all that. So let's go to the ISM website, because what am I really interested in here is the same question that everyone seems to be asking. Are we going to see continued inflation? Or are we seeing a peak in yields, a bottom in the dollar? Can we figure that out? And the answer is we can. So let's go back here and look and see what we find in the manufacturing PMI. So it expanded at a faster rate than the month before. So it went from 60.8 to 64.7. New orders increased at a faster pace. Production increased at a faster pace. Why is production going up? Because economies are reopening. Employment went up at a faster rate. So as production goes up, you need more people. But you get these big supplier delivery print, and this can skew a bit of that headline number. Inventory is virtually unchanged. Customer inventories, or the customer saying way too low. I have a hunch that at some point with all these ships in the harbor and all these supply chain issues that this at some point customers will say inventory is too high when demand isn't there. Look at prices paid. We're going to take a look at this one a little closer. It slowed a little bit. Backlog of orders is high. This is where you really are going to see inflation, but there potentially is too much supply chain issue here, and new export orders increase at a slower rate. Imports increased at a slightly faster rate. But let's go down to prices paid. I mean, overall, this is a great report. I mean, there's nothing bad in it at all. So let's go down to prices and see if we can find out if there's going to be inflation. So it says it registered an 85.6%, a decrease of 0.4 percentage points compared to February. And what does it take into account? Aluminum, copper, chemicals, all varieties of steel, plastic, transportation costs, wood, lumber, and all that stuff is factored in there. What is dollar sensitive, my friends? Right, those things right there, that they're very dollar sensitive. And it says 18 industries reported paying increased prices and raw materials for March across pretty much everything. But look at the number here. And what you see is the index peaked in February and has slowed down in March. Not a lot, but slowed down a little bit. And what's key is prices paid where it peaks. Either that month you get a equal peak in treasury yields, or you're within 3 months. So anywhere from 0 to 3 months, a peak in the ISM prices paid, peak in treasury yields, also bottom in dollar. So here's that chart. We've looked at this before from our friend Julian Biddle of Pickett Asset Management. And notice this, you see a peak in ISM prices paid, and we're looking at a peak in yields. Here you go, see peak to peak, 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 peak. You see it every time. You're within 0 to 3 months. And if we go and look at the actual charts here, I mean, where do you see treasury yields at least as peaked as of March 18th? Well, where did the ISM peak? In February, at least as of right now. How about the dollar? Well, let's go down and look at the trade weighted dollar. Where did it bottom? It bottomed in January with a kind of a second soft bottom late in February. So where do you see a similar bottom in the dollar matching ISM prices paid's peak, suggesting that yes, we are seeing a peak in yields. We are seeing a bottom in the dollar, and that bottom in bond prices that here you go see is kind of matched up in March. So everyone says that yields can only go higher, but well, the ISM is telling us not so fast here. It doesn't look like that to be true. All right, let's go on to what do we have next? Payroll report. Ah, yes, non-farm payroll report. Now this was a big number, 916,000. Some projected it to be well over a million, but when you look at the prior 2 month revision, it was 1.072 million. Some people were estimating as high as 1.6 million, but you look across the board, manufacturing payrolls up 53,000, government payrolls up 136. Probably some of this is an education sector. I know there's a lot of subs that are gonna be needed and other people to help work in the classrooms and maintenance in terms of cleaning and all that. Private payrolls, 780,000. I mean, we know this because businesses are reopening. So they've seen some big numbers here. Even hourly earnings, though, it dipped a little bit. Now, why does that happen? Now, is that necessarily a terrible thing? Well, what it's telling you is, of all these jobs that were added, there's quite a few of them that are low-paying jobs. It makes sense. Restaurant and leisure hospitalities are not high-paying jobs. And so it's going to bring down the average hourly earnings a little bit, brought down the year-over-year from 5.2 to 4.2, so nothing bad there. How about the participation rate? It was only up slightly. Now the participation rate is pretty interesting because it tells you the percentage of the people that are age eligible that are choosing to participate in the workforce, whether they're actually employed or looking for a job. And then there's everyone else that's not doing anything. And so one of the questions I had, and we posted a chart on Twitter yesterday, they said, look, is there something else going on here? And the answer is potentially. Here's a chart I posted. It had its cash assets at all commercial banks. Now, what are cash assets? Well, these include vault cash, cash items in the process collection, balances due from depository institution, and here's the key one, balances due from Federal Reserve banks, which is QE. So here's what we're seeing is on a weekly basis, we can see the effects of QE. And I have inverted it against the labor force participation rate. Because when we get to talk about the Macro Voices interview, if you haven't listened to already, we talk about how dollars get trapped in prison and brings the money velocity down. Well, when you do that, you don't get a lot of jobs because there isn't enough money to go around. And this is not updated as of today's print, but you see the cash assets going down and the red line would have gone up 0.1%. That's it. So what we're seeing is QE is having a suppressionary effect on the labor force participation rate, which is pretty interesting. Now, do I assume that there's going to be jobs created out of this? Absolutely. We should see in the next couple months more jobs created. Does it mean we'll beat this 1 million print? I don't know. It's almost too early to call. It just depends on how far the states open, but there's something in the unemployment data that is kind of a head scratcher. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And we'll look at that. What else from the payroll report that was interesting? We're 8.4 million jobs short of where we started, 11 million if you factor all the jobs that weren't created that are normally created. So we're 11 million shy, and you think, how is that inflationary if we're 11 million shy? It's not, because when we were at full employment before the pandemic, interest rates were going down. We were seeing disinflation. So that isn't telling us anything important other than higher More jobs is not necessarily inflationary. We just looked at the chart that says, hey, it doesn't seem to have any relation. If there is a relationship, the relationship is yields are going lower. Yields are going lower, not higher. And how about the headline unemployment rate dip from 6.2 to 6.0%? All car sales, all truck sales, both up. All right, let's go back to the unemployment data. And here it is. This is, you know, kind of the one thing that really bothers me. Now, keep in mind that these payroll reports are usually kind of like second to third week of a month to second to third week, because they need, you know, about a week to 10 days or so to compile the data to get to their out for the report. So when it says, you know, it's a March report, it's really kind of mid-February to mid-March-ish, somewhere in there. So you, but these unemployment data are as of the prior week. So this is what's interesting to me, is despite 1 million jobs added over the last 3 months, we've continued, except for last week, the week before last, we've continued to see initial claims over 700,000. So we saw 719,000 people file initial claims. Is it, so what's going on in the economy? See, this is where I'm challenged, because in a normal economy, you should see 200,000 to 300,000 jobs claims. Not a big deal, because people are changing jobs, losing jobs, things are happening. If we're in a recovery and all these jobs are coming back and everyone's going back to work, would it make sense that the unemployment claims might be artificially lower, maybe 100,000 to 200,000, maybe 50,000 to 150,000, but still a 700? What is that telling you? There's a revolving door. People are going back to work and losing their jobs, going back to work and losing their jobs. So something here doesn't make sense, and this is where it is. Now, we do see total claims, including all forms of pandemic assistance, drop 1.5 million last week. So that's a positive sign. Maybe, you know, we're seeing some people get off the payrolls and go back to work. I don't know, but still 18.2 million people receiving some form of unemployment assistance, which is staggering, just staggering. All right, what else we got? Oh, yes, this is interesting. This is the AAII allocation of stocks and bonds based on surveys. So what it's showing is that stocks have an unusually high allocation among investors, means they're very bullish on stocks. Usually that happens near peaks. And those who are have allocation to cash, again, these are surveys, and they're showing cash levels are very low, which we've known for a while, which suggests that once everyone's all in on one side and it flips to the other, well, there's usually some problems that go along with that. All right, so let's talk about Macro Voices interview. I've got that linked in the description below. I even linked a chart pack for you too, so how about that? And I've also linked some notes that I put together to kind of help you, you know, so if you listen to it, or maybe you listen to it a couple of times, I've certainly listened to plenty of Macro Voices interviews more than once myself. I wanted to do a write-up to give you some notes to go with that, to help you kind of understand some of these concepts, and they're on the website. Just so you know, none of these things are going to be by email. Managing an email list is not something I'm interested in, so if you want to see this as they're posted, you need to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Facebook, or check my website periodically, or watch the show, and I'll link them in the description when I post them, so you can check that out. All right, so let's try to go through some of the concepts in that interview. And I really felt it was a really good interview, because it was the first time I'd been able to kind of go through my deflationary thesis and explain some of the concepts on the show. It's all been piecemeal, but this was kind of one straight through. So there's a big question that comes up repeatedly, is this reserve swap. You know, people say, well, I thought that the Fed can buy bonds from primary dealers. Now, you have to understand, primary dealer banks, what is their role? Sell securities. They buy treasury securities at auction, and they sell them. They kind of buffer them. That's what their role is, sell securities on behalf of the government, so they don't have to run daily or weekly auctions for, you know, the treasury note and treasury bonds. They do that for bills. Bill auctions they run every week, but this just allows the government not to continuously run, you know, note and bond auctions. So that's what their role is. Their job is not to sit on them and hold them. Now, one of the problems people, where they get confused, is many of the primary dealer banks are owned by commercial banks. So we know that quantitative easing is what's called a reserve swap. So you have to first have a bank reserve in order to swap it. That is the key part to all this. Now, why would a primary dealer have a bank reserve? What are they reserving for? Their job is to sell, not to hold. That's what their role is. But it was some of you remember this was something I struggled with for a while, trying to piece this together. And then there was that report from the U.S. Treasury where it talked about how banks need to buy bonds to pay interest on customer deposits, and it's based on duration, and you know, they're independent on if it's a corporate or a consumer deposit. You know, the banking system believes the money's there from 3 to 5 years, so they buy everywhere from 4-week T-bills all the way out to 7-year bonds. That's what they tend to buy, and when they're doing that, they're buying it with customer deposits. Now, this is where everyone's like, okay, I don't get that. Why would they do that? Well, one of the things about fractional reserve banking, when you really understand, go back to the original, you know, when it kind of started, is banks became a place for people to put their money to store it. And it wasn't that they used it that often. Sometimes they came in and needed it, but there was money that was circulating. But when they had excess money, they went to the bank and deposited there. And then over time, then banks decided, well, we need to pay interest on that money. And how are we going to do that? We're going to lend it out and create fractional reserve, because what they found in these early banks is, hey, people leave their money here for long periods of time. And even if they come get it, there's other people that are parking their money here for a long period of time. So we don't need to have access to all this money simultaneously. And so that's where a bank reserve comes from. A bank can either lend against those assets or they can buy treasury securities. And that's what they do. They create a bank reserve. And all the Fed is doing is swapping the reserve. They're taking that treasury reserve, putting it on their balance sheet, and giving the banks what's called a reserve asset or an overnight reserve. So the example I used in Macro Voices was, we have a 2-year treasury note that's a bank reserve, and it becomes an overnight reserve asset. That's all that you see is going on. So the confusion about, well, I thought they were buying from primary dealers. Well, if they were buying directly from primary dealers, it'd be money printing, because the dealer goes and buys it at the auction, the Fed comes in and buys it from them. That's money printing. But there's a step that gets missed. The dealer sells it to the commercial bank, who may just happen to own them. That's cool. And what is a commercial bank getting that money from? The customer deposits. That's really a key point. And that's where we come back to why, and I hope this makes sense, is why do we need fiscal stimulus? Why did Powell need it? Because, you know, I use this Pac-Man analogy that over time, QE eats up all those bank deposits. And what happens when you run out of them? And you've got every last bank deposit tied up. They become bank reserves, and they've been swapped, and there's none left. Then you can't do QE anymore. You can't. It stops. When Pac-Man has no snack pellets to eat, the round ends. That's how the game is played. So how do you keep the game going? You put more snack pellets on the board. And what are snack pellets? Customer deposits. How do you get customer deposits? Well, if you're the Fed chair, you go around beating your drum, telling Congress every which way possible, every press release, we need fiscal stimulus, need fiscal stimulus, need fiscal stimulus. Don't need it because he thinks it's inflationary. He needs it because they're snack pellets. And he knows if the government borrows money and gives it to people, some of it will end in the commercial banking system, and those deposits in the commercial banking system will convert to treasury reserves, and then QE can eat them. And that is the key part to all of this. Is now it takes us to the next part that people get confused about, is this dollar prison. So what happens is, Once a reserve is QE'd and becomes a reserve asset, that reserve asset is owned by the Fed. So it's very important. When a bank creates a treasury, a reserve with a treasury, they could sell it. But once the Fed takes control of it, the Fed can say this can be sold. It can only do that through quantitative tightening, which we know they're not going to do anytime soon. I mean, no time soon. So what's the problem? Well, when you have a small number of commercial banks that participate in the system here, where they can hold reserve assets, very key. The bank has to be able to hold reserve assets. And what we've learned from Jeff Snyder is, at the end of every day, rather than swapping a whole ton of cash or back and forth, the banks settle up their bills to each other. And, you know, my bank may owe your bank, you know, and so then they pay it, and then another bank may owe me money and they pay it. And it's just settled by some swapping of reserves. It's all netted out by the system, and everyone pays their bill in reserves and internally accounts for it. So only the commercial banks that are on this reserve system are the ones that can handle reserve assets. And because there's not a lot of them, dollars get trapped in the system because they can only move within these banks that can handle these reserve assets. So they can't get to your, say, community bank. They're not going to get to your local credit union because they don't transact in reserve assets. So what happens is the velocity of money gets crammed down. And that's where you see this cash assets chart, because I showed in the Macro Voices chart pack that if you invert cash assets against the velocity of money, well, what you find out is the more QE you do, because remember, cash assets, what do they have? Balances due from Federal Reserve banks. It's QE. So what happens is the more money you lock into this prison of this commercial banking system, the lower the velocity of money, the fewer jobs you're going to have, lower interest rates you're going to have. And eventually, what happens is you start building up this liquidity trap. And the liquidity trap, this is also probably one of the key and things to understand, is when money demand, which is QE. So when the demand for money, right? Remember, we just talked about Pac-Man, right? What is he eating? Those snack pellets. And what are those snack pellets? Customer deposits. That's the demand for money. Do you see how this is all coming together now? So when money demand increases more than proportionally to the money supply, that M2 money supply, there is disinflation or deflation, and aggregate price level must fall to close the gap between, must fall. And this gets confusing, because some people say, well, but Steve, food prices are up, energy prices are up. Look at the core CPI. That's why I showed that in the chart pack. Go look at that. You know, look at cash assets versus core CPI. So you can have higher food prices, you can have higher energy prices, but you're gonna have lower other prices somewhere else, because what a liquidity trap is telling you is there's a dollar shortage. And why is there a shortage? Because we're crushing the velocity of so much money. And the longer this persists, right? And how do we see that? Well, this is the money multiplier made famous by Dr. Lacey Hunt, probably other people, but he's the only one I've ever heard talk about it. And here you're seeing that ratio between the M2 money supply and the monetary base. And what it's showing is the monetary base is growing more proportionally than the money supply, and that is the liquidity trap. Now, the longer this liquidity trap goes on, the worse it gets. It's like a black hole. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And what happens is a black hole gets bigger and bigger, right? Things get stuck in it. Things that you don't want stuck in it are like, and they go woof right into it. Now, I look back at past QE programs. They ran 2 years in length, and then the Fed quit. Well, we're 6 months away from 2 years, and there's no sign of stoppage. So what happens is the bigger the liquidity trap gets, eventually things get sucked in and the whole system breaks. Either asset prices crash, interest rates go down, dollar goes up, you get this massive shortage because too many dollars have got trapped in the system. And that's why I showed the last chart in the chart pack was all loans and leases at commercial banks, because where is money created? Through the lending system, right? Now it all comes together, right? We need new lending growth to create new money, but there's been none in the last year. And we know, because we've been watching this, it's gonna start contracting, which puts downward pressure on the money supply. And so all that means is there's going to be an increasingly large dollar shortage. The black hole is the dollar shortage. It's what it is. A liquidity trap is a dollar shortage, and the bigger it gets, right? At some point, what happens to the dollar? Well, all of a sudden, the demand for dollars goes up. Financial conditions tighten. And then what happens? All of a sudden, out of that, you get interest rates start to come crumbling down. Why do interest rates go down? Because what gets people to borrow when there's a shortage of dollars? Higher interest rates or lower interest rates, right? If you don't have enough dollars, which is going to get you to borrow money, right? It's this one, lower interest rates. And then what happens when all of that, boom, risk assets crash because there's not enough money to support them. And there you go, my friends. That is the whole story. And hopefully that helps. If you listen to the Macro Voices interview, you've got the notes there. You've got this video. I appreciate all of you. Happy Easter. Happy Good Friday. I'll see you on Sunday for the chart show. And then, of course, we'll be back as normal for the Monday macro show. And what I'm about trying to figure out is where my other slides went. And that's where we'll look at the banking data, because the markets were closed today. We'll see. So all that hype about higher interest rates, it's all hype. Be well. Bye now. The content of this video is provided as educational information only. It's not intended to provide investor advice. This is chosen not to be construed as a recognition or solicitation by a Social Security financial instrument or to participate in a particular trading strategy. This video was prepared by Steve Van Meter. Personal capacity opinions expressed in this video that I'm doing not reflect the view of Atlas Financial Advice, Inc. or Steve Van Meter Financial.